On today's Bill of the Flatus Show, episode 175, Alabama, Missouri, and Indiana, Baby from Venus, Totalitarian Techniques, and Remorse. All of this and more.
The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose.
Welcome to the Flatus Show. A low-calorie carbonated beverage for my diet. Welcome to the Flatus Show. I am your host, Kenty, and my co-host, Jose, is shopping at Bloomingdale's. Been a wonderful week. Spring is on its way. Wasn't the wonderful weather wonderful this week, especially in the Northeast? It was very nice. And today we get snow. And I was like, fuck. Oh, sorry. Hold on. I have to. Let me go back. I'm not supposed to be cursing anymore. I'm going to stop that because, not that I think it's bad, it's just that I curse too much. I've gotten used to it, and that's wrong. Why is it wrong? Because it devalues language. The shock is gone. I don't want people to get used to me cursing, because I'm not that kind of person. I'm not that person. I'm the ukulele boy. I'm the good boy. And, and so you just better get used to that, okay? Because I really am not a potty-mouthed person. I am a good person. I am good. You know that already. But, I'm going to... I will continue to burp. Because there's nothing wrong with burping. But as for language, I'm going to pay much more attention and be careful so I don't overuse certain language. Otherwise, it won't have any meaning. It'll be like the boy who cried wolf. You know, I'm going to cry wolf. And you're going to say, but there is no wolf, or no cunt, or fuck. Okay, so anyway, how was your week? I'm sitting here, looking out the window, looking at the snow that fell. And I told God, I said, God, enough. Spring is on its way in a few weeks. We can't have any more snow, okay? And he said, okay, I'll stop it. But apparently he's going to start tomorrow. So I'm like, God, you better let this storm pass into the ocean. Because I can't handle another snowstorm. I mean, it's enough out there right now. It's a pain in the butt. It's going to be a pain in the butt cleaning it up. And if we get a foot tomorrow, doesn't God know I have to work? I have a schedule that I have to work. We have to close in 2 days. That's an accounting term, okay, because I work in an accounting environment. We have to do closing, the month-end closing, in 2 days. How can we do a closing in 2 days if I can't get there? So, God, not now, okay? Not even, just wait till next year, okay? Enough snow. Don't you have enough postcards? So, now when I say God, please be aware that I'm not referring to Jesus Christ, because I don't believe he is God. I'm referring to God, that who is, God, you know, just one God, who is God, okay? But now, also be aware that I don't care of you whether you believe me or not, or whether there is a God or not, because, you know, perhaps my belief system encourages or includes the possibility that God doesn't exist. And I'm not trying to convince you one way or the other. You can do whatever you want. I have come to my own personal conclusions, and that's that. Okay? So, whatever.
Hello.
Hi, this is Marvin Bloom. Hey, Kenty. Oh, I feel like we're on a first name basis now or something. Thank you for playing my message the other day. Very affirming. And I've been listening to your program. It's sounding wonderful. And I don't know, something was said in it, the most recent one, that I just felt guilty, you know, and it just kind of brought to my mind my sordid past. And I do have a very sordid past. You know, in particular, I used to be ex-gay. You know, I was one of those people who tried to de-gay themselves, like trying to debone a fish or something. Anyway, it didn't work, of course. But I was radical about it, so much so that I ran my own ex-gay ministry in Alabama. What I was doing in Alabama, do you don't want to know. Anyway, it was called Straightway Ministries, which wasn't the title I first had for it. I wanted it to be called the Sword of Truth Ministries, because the Word of God is like a sword, you know, so Sword of Truth Ministries. But the pastor, he didn't like it. Anyway, I say all that because, you know, the guilt, the shame, you know, it weighs on me because I realize now what a wrong thing that was, you know, and, you know, and I just feel responsible. And I know this isn't the Kenty confession line, although, you know, I bet if you opened it up, you'd get some very interesting things. But, you know, I just felt I could confide in you and, you know, and share that with you and your listeners as a sort of public apology for my role in, you know, trying to straighten people out. Hair, you can straighten. Gays, not so much. Anyway, you're wonderful. God bless you. Have a great day. Goodbye.
Bye. Talk to you later.
Well, thank you, Marvin. Thank you for that phone call. I'd love to hear from you whenever you call. As anybody wants to leave a confession at the Kenty line at 206-984-3617, please do. In fact, I encourage you to confess because, you know, as I am confessing today, that I felt remorse about my use of language in the past, these past few shows. And actually on that Facebook, when I called Prescott Bush a cunt publicly on Facebook, well, you know, on my wall, I started feeling remorse because I thought, I'm not that person, you know. And it's so easy to fall into to that trap, you know, of using language or whatever, and getting involved with things that aren't you, you know. Now, let me explain. For myself, I didn't have a turn or burn ministry, which Marvin did. He had a turn or burn ministry. And in fact, you know, Marvin, what did I say that made you want to confess? Because I think it's fascinating because I didn't know about that. But I was wondering what I said, what was said on the show. That made you want to tell me to, because I like you anyway. I don't care. Even if you were still in your turn and burn phase, I'd like you. How's that? Because I like people. And if I like you, I like you. I don't care who you are. Unless you're like some sort of, you know, Uganda rebel who takes young children and puts rifles in their arms and chops off the arms and limbs of people that you don't like. Actually, I think it's Liberia, maybe. Not Uganda. Sorry if I offended anybody in Uganda. Rwanda, maybe? I don't know. It's in over there. I think it's East Africa. Or maybe it's West Africa. Liberia's in West Africa. Somewhere in Africa, they're putting arms into they're making boys, little kids into soldiers, and then chopping off the hands and arms of people. It's terrible. But anyway, that's not the confession I have today. My confession is one of language, and it's not that I think the word cunt is a bad word. It's just, or fuck even, but, you know, I use it too much. Anyway, the reason why it flows off my tongue occasionally. And, you know, I go for stretches without using it. It's just that I feel really guilty about using it over the past few weeks, okay? So, please forgive me. I am not that person. The influence comes from my friend Leslie, this woman, this Jewish lady that John and I knew. And I'm not saying Jewish lady to blame it on the Jews, because, you know, that's too easy. But she was a Jewish lady who, I'm not really sure if she was too religious, but she had a mouth on her. She would be like, cunt and this and everything else. And I was shocked when I first met Leslie. And, but she had life, you know, she has gusto. She has gusto. I'm not that kind of person, but she was. And so the word, now John and I, you know, we'll talk about Leslie and talk about her use of the language. But publicly, I don't, publicly, you know, that makes me seem like I am a hypocrite. Because if I use the word publicly, I mean privately, then why not publicly, right? It's not like I go around privately in my house saying cunt, 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 you know. I think I've used the word more. I think I've, in my remorse and in my confession of using the word cunt, I think I've used the word cunt more often than any other time on this show, which is supposed to be a remorseful show about not using language to desensitize people to its full shock value. But why should it be shocking? There really should be no reason why it's shocking, okay? But I'm not going to use it because it, the connotation in today's society is, it is, you know, it's just, I don't want to be the person who curses all the time. I'm not a curser. I really am not. You know, I say, oh, my stars a lot. You know, that's my, usually the point, you know, that my exclamation. I'm afraid I'm painting a picture of myself, which is unfair. It's a view which is not true. And this is, you know, social media and, you know, truthfulness, whatever truthfulness is. But, I mean, I'm being honest and open, I mean, as much as I can be. I mean, I am me, you know. You are you. I am one of seven. I'm a Borg. No, but you know what I'm saying? You know I'm sighing. You know I'm sighing. So, anyway. Okay, next is a friend of mine. I'll call him Tom. An old friend from high school and then college. He reminded me of some things I want to talk about. Orph and Baby from Venus, which I think I might mention later on the show. But the Baby from Venus, I have to find out about that. I forget about the Baby from Venus. It's all stuff that happened in high school. In college, I guess. The first couple years of college. Now, let me tell you about Tom. Is Tom... He transferred into the senior year, I think, junior or senior year into in the Abington High School. And he went to, he was in the theater groups and stuff. You know, we did the plays and stuff together. And he had good roles. He was a good actor. He got the good roles. So he got the good role, Mr. Gibbs or whatever, in our town. But... we went to college together, and he came from a well-off family. I mean, he lived in a nice neighborhood, and I came from, you know, not such a nice family. We had both had nice families, except his had money and mine didn't. And he was very generous to me, is that those days when I went to school, to Temple University, because I would have just enough money, most times, there was just enough money to get to school and get back from school with maybe a quarter or two left over for lunch. And I was there at 5, you know, in the morning or whatever, and came home at 6 o'clock at night. I was there for a long day. And many times all I had was a pretzel to eat because the pretzels were 25 cents. That was my lunch. Now, when... on a good day, I had some extra money, and I would get the Chinese food. They had this great Chinese food truck, and the trick was, is if you talked to the lady who owned it, this Chinese lady, and you said, oh my God, this food is the best Chinese food ever, she would just glop more and more of the food into your plate. And so that's how I made $2, you know, really go really far. I'd ask for the chicken chow mein. I'm like, this is the best chicken chow mein ever. I'm going to bring all my friends down here. She'd go, oh, really? Glop, 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 glop. She must have known I was poor. I'll give you an extra egg roll, you know. So, you know, I got extra food that way. And, but, you know, many times, you know, I wasn't, didn't have that extra $2. And I was, you know, ended up having a pretzel. Many times I didn't even have those. I had just enough money to get to school and get back from school. And what I would do is I would go down into the student activity center, and they had these lockers. And what you would do is you would put a quarter in, right, and you would get your key. And then when you came back and opened up the locker, you'd get your quarter back. Well, I would wait there for people to get their, you know, stuff out and leave their quarter because they didn't know or they, you know, missed it. And so I would go run up and scan and find quarters that way and have lunch or go out, buy a pretzel or whatever. But, yeah, those were the days. It's a lot different now. And ever since that time, whenever I have extra money, I will help people eat because that's what I learned. And Tom was, anyway, getting back to Tom, this is not about me. Tom fed me. He would buy my lunch. He would do it really nicely. He goes, do you want lunch? You know, I'm going to have lunch. And I'm like, I don't have any money. Oh, pal, I'll get it for you. It was only $2 or $3, but it was the nicest thing. I will always remember that. And Tom is a real sweetheart. And now, you know, like I said, you know, I wasn't always generous, but now, ever since that time, whenever I have money, I will, you know, include people because I think that's important. Food is important to feed people because there's enough starvation, and it's it can be difficult for people. You know, I would if somebody asked me to help them, you know, buy, you know, get food, I would show them which foods to buy and how to make it to make it stretch and last. That's something else I learned from my friend Lila. That's why I think I talk about her. Maybe I talk about her later. But she was with Tom too. Tom, that's all around the same time. Tom and Lila and Sean and me. But it's important to share and you know, whatever. So enough of that. On with the show.
Lash. That's Brenda Starr you hear, finishing up her scoop just for you.
Brenda Starr. Hi, kids. This is the Brenda Starr update. Last week, Ringo admitted his feelings of love for Brenda Starr, but we find out that she never heard what he said, so she makes him repeat it. And his declaration of love makes her feel like she is drowning. So Ringo apologizes because he feels that his declaration of love is being coercive and that, what did I write here? That the wonders of love, he feels that the wonders of love should be a gift and not an obligation. Brenda tells him that she's leaving the next day. So she suggests that they have a good night, that they go out and, you know, talk. All right. So they head off to a bar and get some champagne. And Brenda tells Ringo that it isn't only because of Basil that she does not feel the same way. She tells Ringo that, you know, you dazzle and enchant me, and that frightens me. So Ringo feels bad because he feels like he's encouraged Brenda to betray Basil. And Brenda finally says, well, there's more to the story with Basil, Ringo. I'll let you know what that is. But what happens is that by this time, Ringo and Brenda are on the street walking, and with their bottle of champagne, they're drinking it like winos. And Ringo writes something on the paper, this piece of paper, and pops it into the empty champagne bottle and asks Brenda for the cork. And then he throws it into the Seine, And he tells her, I hope that one day you will find this on the shores of America and it will remind you of this evening. And Brenda says, well, in case your navigation is off, why don't you tell me what it said? And he says, it was a poem by Hafiz. And this is the poem. I realize that the dawn, when we will meet again, will never break. So I give it up, little by little, this love. Brenda, thinking that this is the end of the poem, says, I'm sorry for the both of us. I'm really sorry, Ringo. But Ringo says, there's more. But something in me laughs, and I say this. Someone shaking his head and chuckling softly. Hardly, hardly. So, does Brenda tell Ringo about Basil? Will Brenda find the bottle upon her return to the U.S.? Will Brenda and Ringo get arrested for public drunkenness? Has Basil come back to return to Kazuka-san safely? And is Sage still sleeping at Madame Leduce's apartment? We'll possibly find the answers to these questions and more next week.
Moonlight bringing memories I love, my heart singing over and over the song of a rover. Oh, shine in all my dreams, Missouri moon. There's someone I see waiting there for me. Underneath your beams, Missouri moon. Longing for the days that used to be. Shadows falling bring back recollections. Homeland calling wakens old affections. Tonight, please send your bright and silvery light. Tell her that I'll be with her soon, Missouri moon. Moonbeams gleaming over land or sea. Set me dreaming, for they remind me of joys left behind me, oh. Shine in all my dreams, Missouri moon. There's someone I see waiting there for me. Underneath your beams, Missouri moon. Days that used to be. Shadows falling bring back recollections. Homeland calling wakens old affections. Tonight, please send your bright and silvery light. Tell her that I'll be with her soon, Missouri moon.
The John Birch Society. I think I've talked about the John Birch Society before. And quickly, it's an arch-conservative group that was founded in 1958 in Indiana. And they have a chapter in every state. They are The society supports traditionally conservative causes such as anti-communism, support for individual rights, and the ownership of private property. It promotes U.S. independence and sovereignty and opposes globalism and international regional groups such as the European Union, or what the society claims is a proposed North American Union. That's from Wikipedia. Wikipedia for all your information needs. So here we have the John Birch Society. And if you read through here, it sounds like... I'm trying to find I'm trying to find this one quote in here because it sounds exactly what conservative groups sound like today. Now, let me backtrack, because this sort of started with a misunderstanding on my part from a friend, what a friend wrote on my Facebook page. We'll call him Tom. And Tom wrote down something, a reference, Baby of Venus, or Baby from Venus, or something like that. And I was thinking, what's Baby from Venus? It sounds vaguely familiar. And I was thinking maybe it means Lila, because Lila was our friend, this older woman, and we met at Temple University when I went there. It was 1983, and she was in her 40s, and she was very fascinating. I mean, she had all these. She was very exotic. She lived in the suburbs of Jersey. She was going back to get her degree, and she's a poet. Just bedazzled the three of us, was Tom and Sean and I. And she told us all these stories about how she joined the Republican Party in the 60s and how she changed the neighborhood in her neighborhood. She was living in the northeast Philadelphia. And how she got it started. I mean, she's the one who started it. She started the Republican movement. And it was, you know, I mean, we weren't Republicans, John and I, and I don't know about Tom. But it always struck me how she said how it worked through going to Tupperware parties. You know, it's like how women's groups meet, and then women's groups would meet, or like traditionally, like Tupperware, right? And how they would have a Tupperware party, but throughout the Tupperware party, they would have political discourse. And for the most part, Lila said, is that many of the women didn't have a position. So when you present a position which sounds strong and well-supported, and it's the first time they've ever heard of a political position, they're easily converted because they have nothing to compare it to. They're not... You know, they haven't really – I've talked about this before. They're not self-identified. They're not self-actualized. They don't understand what's at stake. But it's exciting because everybody wants to be part of a group and wants to do the right thing. So when you start, you know, spouting off propaganda, you know, it sounds like good political discourse. And so what it does is that these people eventually, I mean, you know, who knows what happens to people? I mean, if they change their minds, I'm sure they do. Some do, but some don't. And that's their political outlook is what they were told, you know, because, you know, it started in the beginning that if anybody wears long hair, they're communists, you know. But anyway, I'm getting away from the point. But this John Birch Society... Okay, it's all over the United States, and I want to read something about it right here in Wikipedia. Wikipedia for all your information needs. My old eyes need to bring the computer closer. Okay, it says here, the society's objective. Okay, another thing here is that Ayn Rand had Ayn Rind or whatever her name is. You know, Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. She had a criticism of the John Birch Society because it was anti-communism, but it wasn't pro-capitalism. Isn't that interesting? So, it says here, the society's objective has been to fight communism and totalitarianism using some of communism's own techniques. Organization of front groups, infiltration of other groups, and letter-writing campaigns. It has organized grassroots chapters in every state and is the only such organization to have a full-time paid field staff assisting those chapters. Its activities include distribution of literature, pamphlets, magazines, videos, and other educational material while sponsoring a speakers bureau, which invites speakers who are keenly aware of the motivations that drive political policy. One of the first public activities of the JBS was a Get Us Out of Membership of the UN campaign, which claimed in 1959 that the real nature of the UN is to build a one-world government. In 1960, Welch advised JBS members to join our local PTA at the beginning of the school year, get your conservative friends to do likewise, and go to work to take it over. One Man's Opinion, a magazine launched by Welch in 1956, was renamed American Opinion and became the John Birch Society's official publication. The Society's current publication is called The New American. So there you have it, kids. These are some of the they use totalitarian techniques to spread their own political discourse or propaganda. So what's the difference between the John Birch Society and, Lenin or whatever? And these are the same techniques that the religious right uses. In fact, is the religious right a front group for the John Birch Society? I mean, they talk about the same thing. They're against the one world government, okay? Whatever the reason is behind the John Birch Society, I don't know. The religious right, they give their – it's all based on their apocalyptic view of, Revelation, their theory of So it all – it boils down to Hal Lindsey, because he's the one who wrote The Late Great Planet Earth. He's the one who proposed this left behind scenario with all these political machinations. Was he part of the John Birch Society? Is he the one to infiltrate the fundamentalists to get them to be politically motivated? Perhaps. Maybe it was the John Birch Society who goosed the fundamentalists and, started spreading this, these ideas to get them their goat up. Because I doubt they even thought about one world government, 100 years ago, these fundamentalists. But all of a sudden, when they're reading Revelations or Daniel or whatever kind of prophetic book they're reading, and I say that because that's what they're calling them, okay? That's the books they use, Ezekiel and what have you. Oops, did I stop recording here? No, I didn't. They are all against the one world government. I mean, it is true that you can prove almost anything with the Bible. So, the school boards. Remember I tell you about how even our Fair Rockport, we had some anti-evolutionary, person. I was going to say cocksucker, but I feel bad about saying cunt all the time, and I don't want to come off as that kind of person. I really am a nice guy, and I don't want to really want to clean up my language because I am a nice guy. I am a responsible guy. I'm a fair guy. I'm not just some, cursing person, like some on the internet. Do I have a colorful language? Yes. I come from beer and pretzels stock, okay? I don't come from champagne and silver spoons. So, I spit at the, when people act like they're, higher than thou or, they're better than thou or whatever it is, you know. They're the hypocrites, you know. Because, you know, who knows what they're doing. It's like Barbara Bush looks like she has a stick up her ass and she's so prim and proper. Then she comes off and says, it's okay for, you know, the people in New Orleans to be in a FEMA shelter or whatever because it's better than what they had. I mean, who knows what she does, you know? I'd love to get in her mind. I'd love to know what kind of sexual fantasy she has. Okay, let's not go there. Barbara Bush's sexual fantasies. What does it involve? We'll never know. Well, maybe we will. Maybe she'll write about it. You know, we can only hope. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not picking on Barbara Bush because she's Barbara Bush, okay? And she might be a nice lady. You know, I don't know. I'm just picking on her, okay? Okay? People have said worse. Anyway, this John Birch Society, they use the same techniques as the communists and totalitarianism. So what makes them any different than being communist and totalitarian? That's what I'm saying. And the same with all these conservatives, you know? The Democrats, I don't think they do that. They don't infiltrate groups, you know? Maybe they do. I don't know. Do they? Oh, my God. Ted Kennedy, what are you infiltrating? You're infiltrating the Flatus show. Get out. Get out. I will not have it. Maybe he's lost. The Cape Cod is south of here, honey. It's south. You have to take 128 and go south about 4 hours. Or actually about 3 hours, okay? Just leave, okay, Ted Kennedy? Anyway, Ted Kennedy was just here. Hi. Okay, so that's it about the John Birch Society. The same techniques as totalitarianism. Aren't they totalitarianism?
Real American history.
Frontier life. In Indiana. More than 100 years ago, a goodly slice of what was known as the Northwest Territory was set apart as the Territory of Indiana. General Harrison, the famous Indian fighter, and afterward the 9th President of the United States, was appointed governor. Shortly after General Harrison came to Indiana to take charge of affairs, a new and strange trouble with the Indians began. A certain Shawnee Indian named Loud Voice called himself a prophet. He said the Great Spirit would protect him so that he could not be killed. Soon a band of outcast savages looked on him as a great chief. "Do what I tell you to do," he said to them, "and no white man's bullet will ever do you harm. You will win in every battle and drive the pale faces away from our land." Now the prophet was only the tool of his brother, the famous Tecumseh, one of the greatest Indians that ever lived. At this time, Tecumseh was planning to unite the Indians of this region to a general war against the pioneers, and the story of the prophet spread like wildfire from one tribe to another. Hundreds of the Redskins believed that he could make them bulletproof, shield them from wounds and death, and make them win in battle. For several years, they prepared for war, but General Harrison defeated them in the famous Battle of Tippecanoe. 2 years afterward, the brave Tecumseh was killed in the Battle of the Thames. As for the prophet, he was never heard of after the death of his famous brother. During the years of cruel wars with the Indians, the pioneers in the deep woods and on the broad prairies of Indiana lived in dread night and day. By hard toil, the lonely settler would clear a few acres to raise corn, potatoes, and other things for his family. When he went to work in the field, he kept his rifle on the ground near him, while in his belt he carried pistols and a long knife. At night, a dog was on guard in the cabin, while another lay outside. If the dog outdoors barked, the dog inside did the same and so woke up the family. The cabin had portholes so that the settler could fire his gun from inside with little or no risk of exposure. Both men and women were trained to the use of guns from their childhood. A boy of 12 received a rifle and became a soldier in the stockade. A loophole was given him from which he was to shoot when the savages came. The pistols and guns of those days were single-barreled and loaded at the muzzle. They were clumsy affairs with small bore and flintlock. Often, the flint would not strike fire, and the lock had to be snapped several times. The rifles were heavy, with a long barrel and a short stock. But in the hands of a sturdy pioneer, this clumsy weapon was deadly, and the Indians had a great dread of it. In one of the stockades, along the Indian frontier, were gathered 100 people who had fled there for refuge. After a long and hard siege, the fighting force was reduced to 3 men. For 3 weeks they slept in their clothes. No household work was done. Food was cooked and put where those who were hungry could help themselves. After the fight was over, this pioneer, who was then a boy, went with an armed escort of 20 men to the nearest settlement to prove his father's will. The father had been killed by the Indians a few months before. 23 widows were at the log courthouse to look after the property of their husbands, all of whom had been killed by the savages within a year. The early settlers of Indiana had to fight other pests than the Indians. The wolves, foxes, and lynxes killed and ate their sheep, lambs, and pigs. The squirrels and raccoons laid waste their cornfields. Then there were the rattlesnakes and the copperheads. Besides all these was the suffering from chills and fever. Almost every family in the region suffered from some form of ague, now commonly known as malaria. Very few pioneers could spare the time to quit work and go to bed when stricken with this disease. The sturdy backwoodsman plowed his land, and the good wife cooked the meals over the open fire, shaking with chills or burning with fever. Indeed, these people came to regard an attack of ague as a matter of course, and often made grim jokes about it. The story is told of a young man who went out one day in search of a cow. He found one of his neighbors sitting on a log in the woods with his rifle across his knees. "Hello, Jim. What on earth are you doing here?" "I am waiting for my chill to go off so I can shoot the gray squirrel on that tree," replied the victim, and he pointed with shaking fingers to a bushy tail on the topmost branch of an oak. As the story goes, the young fellow took the sick man's rifle and shot the squirrel for him. Such were the men and women who laid the foundation stones of our great states in what was then the West. There is nothing in romance more interesting or instructive than the story of the life of our forefathers.
The smith was once a mighty man. He made those bellows blow. He tended to the flaming forge, all that was years ago. But still the anvil's sad refrain keeps ringing in his brain. Sad is the song of the blacksmith. Clang, clang, clang. Days once were long for the blacksmith. Clang, clang. Task is through. horse for him to shoe, no work for him to do on the anvil. Still by his cottage door, he hears those bellows roar, and dreams forevermore of the anvil. Will he find peace from the anvil? Find peace with the angels. Clang, clang, clang.
Peter DeRose. Okay, this is a really little mini segment. It's not going to last too long. But the song I just sang, the blacksmith song previous to this, that is by Peter DeRose. What is fascinating, because it's not that, you know, it's an okay song. It's interesting. And I think I could, there's actually some things I'd like to do with that song. I'm going to work on it and do another recording of it. But he's the guy who composed Deep Purple, okay? And another interesting fact about his life, and, you know, just interesting how this all works. Now, Peter DeRose, you know, is a Tin Pan Alley composer. He was married to May Singe Breen. And she was a ukulelist. A ukulelist. She played the ukulele, and she would often play the ukulele. They had a radio program called The Sweethearts of America, and he would play piano, and she'd play ukulele, and they would sing his songs and other people's songs. Now, if you look at a lot of sheet music from the period, from, you know, the 20s and 30s or, you know, whatever, a lot of the ukulele arrangements are from May Singe Breen. So she was, you know, pretty good. And I've looked at them, you know, because actually, you know, when I look at the sheet music, the play, you know, look at this old sheet music, I do, you know, take, many times I'll just take it on, faith that what they have written is right. But sometimes it doesn't sound right, so I have to go back and actually look at the music to see if the chords are right. And you know, they are, for the most part, for May Singe Breen. I mean, there are a few little things I found, like I would do the chords differently. But for the most part, she's really good. That's all I want to say about May Singe Breen. I was really surprised that she was married to Peter, that they were, you know, married to Peter DeRose, and he did the Deep Purple song, which is a great song. Another interesting fact here is in 1920, he had his first song hit, which was When You're Gone, I Won't Forget, which sold over 1 million copies, okay? However, this man, Peter DeRose, did not really make much money off of the deal. He sold the song for $25 to the publishers. He sold all of his rights to the song for $25. Imagine that. It's like losing a lottery ticket.
I wonder if the horses have been fed. I will go at once and question old Antoine.
Paul Harvey is dead. Yes, kids, that's right. Paul Harvey, the arch-conservative radio host, is dead at age 90. And he was a talk radio personality. He did the news. Paul Harvey's The News with Paul Harvey or whatever. I don't know what it was exactly. My grandmother used to listen to him because she used to listen to talk radio all the time. But what was really interesting is that Paul Harvey, even though he was like, you know, for McCarthyism until he found out what McCarthy was doing, he was able to change his views. You know, he's against communism, okay? So he was sort of a person who was influenced by the conservative diatribe, but was also able to have his own view and maintain this sort of conservative arch to his the way he interpreted things. It was interesting. He was arch-conservative, you know. He wasn't like the arch-conservatives of today, like arch-villains in Batman. He was pro-equal rights and pro-abortion rights. And that, you know, and he also criticized the religious right, saying, you know, you can't make people do what, you know, the live by your whatever, you know, views. Now, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about the John Birch Society earlier and about how the John Birch Society really is just propaganda because they're using these front groups and stuff to infiltrate groups to have their idea, you know, put forth their idea, which is basically to get rid of a one-world government and to maintain the states, I guess, states. I don't know what it was. I don't even know where it comes from. Sorry. Where they got the idea. But anyway, that's their idea. One-world government, no. Communism, no. Private ownership, yes. So, what was I going to say about Paul Harvey? Hold on. Okay, so what I was saying here is that, yeah, they were against, you know, how these people like the Paul Harvey or whatever and the John Birch Society are against fascism. Now, Paul Harvey was against, criticized the religious right because he saw correctly that they are moral fascists. Remember that, you know, the John Birch Society is sort of against economic fascism, which is occurring, has occurred in the United States for a long, long time, and is occurring now as we speak. I mean, when I say natural world, I mean, I'm not trying to say that, I don't know what is natural. Okay. What does natural mean for a human being, especially when it comes to things like money? Okay. It's an abstract idea, but I would think that banks who are going to fail should fail, right? And the U.S. government's idea is not to prop them up and keep them in business, but to protect the people's protect the people's deposits in those banks, right? As the FDIC says, and keep it, you know, and then have it broken up, you know, have other banks buy them up. Now, of course, there are people with money in those banks with more than $100,000. Well, you know, too bad. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, that's not fair. But, you know, the thing is that you just can't, you can't let them stay. You know, I mean, they were run into the ground. The people who did it should be punished. I mean, is it punishable? People who do a bad job? I mean, you know, suppose you have a secretary who does a bad job. I mean, you're going to punish her with the law? You know, like, can you say the same thing for CEOs? Are CEOs of these big companies more important in a way that can affect, you know, that they affect the economy and every one of us? Are they beholden to higher laws where they should be punished if they do wrong? Whether they do wrong for, whether they knew it or didn't know it, you know, and I'm not trying to say that if they did everything right and the conditions were wrong, but you have to, I think that these people are responsible, you know, and in a way, what has happened is that they're saying, oh, it's business, it's private sector, but what they do, what they decide affects us all. And it's like unelected power. They're unelected power. They'll say that the shareholder elects them, but the shareholders don't elect them. Because, you know, if the shareholders really knew what was going on, do you think they would have given them the big salaries that they got? Or, you know, paid them the bonuses that they had, you know? We look at it in hindsight. Now, I've been talking about this for, you know, in one way or another since I started the podcast. If you go back, I've talked about this before. I've talked about, you know, things like this. It's just now that, you know, it is apparent because of all the stuff that's happening, especially all these money managers taking money. I mean, how can that happen? how many of these money managers are doing this? It's like, that was the job, you're a money manager, so you're going to, like, create Ponzi schemes and just use the money any which way you want? Buying horses or, you know, beating off KY jelly? I don't know. We have to get back. I say we have to get back. I don't even know about getting back to, because this is the only world I've lived in. But to me, whether it's getting back to or not, okay, because I don't want to talk about the past as it is a golden past, because I don't know. I wasn't there. It seems to me that there has to be a higher standard for people to be in power. I mean, especially in companies, like big companies, they have higher budgets than, you know, some small countries, okay? Especially banks, you know? It's too easy. You know, these people, CEOs and stuff, it's too easy for people to get MBAs and stuff like that and to take these positions, you know? It's like, where do these people come from? And, you know, and I'm sure a lot of it has to do with money, family. It's like, you know, it's the son taking over for the father, or, you know, Joe knows. Like I talked about this last week, all the people who go to Yale, you know, it's like the rich people who go to these Ivy League schools. They've been pals since, you know, prep school or whatever. And it's a small percentage. Now, I'm sure these people, if it exists, who knows? I don't know. I don't run in those circles. I don't know those people. You know, maybe I do know them, and I don't know I do know them. But what I'm saying is that there has to be more responsibility. And, care in decisions and stuff like that. You know, it's like, and we have to get back to actually value of things. People, things are so, I'll tell you right now, things are overpriced. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you go, the plumber's making $95 an hour. He came out here and snaked a pipe for $95 an hour. I'm sorry. Get your fat plumber crack ass. It's not worth $95. Now, we paid it because we had to. You know, we made a contract. But what was our choice? You know, what is our choice? And you could say, well, you go around and get people. But, I mean, you know, interview different people. Try to get a better... I need the fucking pipe snaked now. You know, we're going to call a local guy. Fine if you want to charge it, but I guess, and he gets it.
Yeah, but I mean,
one or two people could pay him, and he could be sitting around buying scratch cards and drinking Dunkin' Donuts coffee, you know. Okay. But anyway, I'm going off, and I don't want to do that. Well, maybe I do want to do that, but anyway... That is that, okay?
From Hollywood, Miss Loreen Tuttle in The Unexpected.
The Unexpected.
The Unexpected. Life is filled with the unexpected. Romantic, tragic, and mysterious endings to our most ordinary actions. Dreams come true, or dreams are shattered by sudden twists of fate in The Unexpected. And now, Lorraine Tuttle, outstanding radio and screen star in Finale, a drama of the unexpected.
I couldn't wait any longer. I delayed too much already, putting the terrible moment off from day to day. And now I couldn't put it off anymore. If I did, Kent might learn the truth. Someone might tell him. I thought it my duty to inform you, Mr. Fairfax. What? Mona's never mentioned it? No. The idea was unbearable. I'd have to do it myself. And soon. That afternoon was cold and black and unfriendly. I could feel the darkness closing in. Night was coming early. It pressed against my face, tighter and tighter until I wanted to scream.
Julie! Julie, come here!
Hurry!
Yes, mademoiselle. Is something wrong?
No, of course not. I'm quite all right. Why shouldn't I be all right?
I thought I heard you call.
What? Oh, yes, I've decided to change my dress. I want to wear black.
Black, mademoiselle?
Yes, my black crepe. But don't argue with me, Julie. Do what I tell you.
But I only thought that since you and Mr. Fairfax were going for a drive...
I've changed my mind, that's all. I've just changed my mind.
Oh,
do I have to explain everything to you? Oh, why won't people ever let me live my own life?
You're going to tell him today, aren't you?
That's really none of your business, Julie.
You've decided to tell him today?
All right, so I have. There's no point in putting it off.
You won't be cruel, will you, mademoiselle?
I am never cruel, Julie. Unnecessarily. But I was going to be cruel. You can't get rid of a man who's loved you for years without hurting him. And Kent would be hurt. What difference did it make? I couldn't help it. It would be easier to hurt him. Much easier if I had the strength to do it. Where's my gold comb, Julie? Have you mislaid it again?
I'm sure it's on the dressing table, mademoiselle. Yes, here it is.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Shall I brush your hair?
I'm quite capable of doing it myself.
Of course.
When I need something, I'll ask for it, Julie.
Yes, mademoiselle. I'm very sorry.
Well, what are you waiting for?
Mademoiselle, about the young man this afternoon.
What about him?
He's very much in love with you, you know.
I don't need you to tell me that.
But perhaps you should explain to
him. I've already decided exactly what I'm going to do. Stop prompting me, Julie. For heaven's sake, let me live my own life. I've already decided exactly what I'm going to do. I finished putting on my makeup. But my hands were trembling. And I wasn't sure if I'd done it right. Perhaps I'd added a little too much rouge. I didn't know why, but I was nervous. Terribly nervous. I'd planned the whole thing so carefully. Nothing could go wrong. And yet I was frightened. What time is it, Julie?
4:15, mademoiselle.
Oh. Now, I want to be sure that everything is quite ready. Let's see. He'll come through the door bringing a box of candy or something equally useful. He'll set it on the little table and then... Should I let him kiss me, Julie?
I wouldn't know, mademoiselle.
Now, don't be difficult, please. When I ask you something, answer.
Then I should say it doesn't matter whether you let him kiss you or not.
It makes a great deal of difference, Julie. I think I will let him kiss me. And then I'll turn away and sit over here across the room where he can't see me too clearly. Draw the blinds, Julie. I don't want any daylight in the room. It isn't flattering, and I always feel more comfortable in the dark.
It's almost dark now, mademoiselle.
Close the blinds. There. That's much better. Now, shall I bring up the subject abruptly, or work the conversation gradually around until I'm ready to tell him?
To be abrupt sounds fairer.
I suppose you're right. Get it over quickly. He won't understand at first, and then I'll get up, face the windows... And keeping my back to him, make the whole thing quite clear. It's always much more convincing when you don't look at a man in the face. I wonder why.
I have no idea, mademoiselle.
You think he'll be very angry, Julie?
Probably.
But he'll get over it.
Oh, yes.
You needn't be quite so positive.
I'm sorry.
After it's over, he'll go storming out of the apartment, forgetting his hat. He always does when he's upset. I wonder if he'll come back for it this time. I hope not. And then perhaps I'll keep the hat as a reminder of past love.
You know, Mademoiselle, it won't happen just the way you plan it.
Oh, won't it, Julie? We'll see. At this moment, he's in the elevator riding up to this floor. The car stops. He steps out, mumbles something to the operator, and strides up the hall. Right now, he's taking off his hat and straightening his tie. And just a second, he'll ring the buzzer. Well, open the door, Julie. I'm quite ready for him. Quite ready.
I brought you some candy, Mona.
Thank you, darling.
I'll leave it here on the table.
Oh, all right.
Well, don't I get a kiss?
Yes, of course you get a kiss.
That's more like it. We're going for a drive, remember?
Yes. But first, let's sit here for a moment and talk.
What about?
Well, I'll be very frank, Kent. I think we should settle our problem today and not put it off any longer.
I didn't know we had any problem, Mona.
Oh, Kent, don't be difficult. You must know that something has happened to us.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Well, try to understand what I'm saying, darling. If you haven't been aware of it, that only proves my point.
For heaven's sake, what point?
That we've been drifting. Drifting apart.
Mona, will you please stop beating around the bush and start making sense?
Very well, Kent. It comes down to this. We don't love each other any longer.
You don't love me. Is that what you mean?
Not entirely. It should be obvious that you've stopped caring or you'd have noticed how I've changed.
Have you changed?
Yes, very much. Surely you must have sensed it.
Sensed it? Well, no. Maybe love makes you blind.
Please don't say that, Kent.
Why not?
Well, because I'm still fond of you. I don't want you to be angry with me. I just can't help my feelings, that's all. I can't turn them on and off whenever I choose.
You've done pretty well so far.
All right, Kent. At least I've been fair. You can't say I wasn't honest.
I don't believe you. I don't believe a word you've said. I don't believe that you could stop loving me any more than I could stop loving you.
Can't you stop, Kent? I'm sure you can if you try.
No, not until you convince me. When I know you really don't care, then I'll stop. But not before.
Oh, very well. What's the use of trying to be kind? You may as well know it all. I'm leaving town tomorrow. I won't be back, ever.
That's very sudden.
Yes, it's quite sudden. But Arthur insisted.
Arthur?
You don't know him, Kent. I didn't myself until a week ago. He's very attractive and quite charming. And I'm going to marry him. Do you hear me, Kent? I'm going to marry him. I'm going to marry him.
I heard you. Is he rich?
Oh, Kent, that's very unkind. I want you to leave now. I won't let you talk to me that way. I won't let anyone talk to me that way.
Sorry.
But for your information, since it seems so important, Arthur is quite well to do.
Then I'm sure you'll be happy together.
I'm sure of it, too. Now, will you please go?
Shouldn't I kiss the bride? Isn't that what I'm supposed to do at a time like this?
No. Not until after the wedding.
I don't think I'll be able to attend. Thanks just the same. Have fun, Mona. Always have fun. And live a wonderful life. And forget about me. I know that won't take much effort. Goodbye, Mona. And good luck.
Can't you... You forgot your hat?
You think it's all over, don't you? But wait. Fate takes a hand. Wait for the unexpected. And now for the surprising conclusion of Finale, starring Loreen Tuttle, a Hamilton Whitney production, written by Robert Libbett and Frank Burt, and directed by Frank K. Danzig.
Oh, Ken. Ken, darling.
Is everything all right, Mademoiselle?
Yes, Julie.
Yes, everything's all right.
And you were wrong.
Wrong?
It went just as I expected. Every detail.
Then you didn't tell him the truth?
I convinced him that we were through. That was enough of the truth.
If you say so, Mademoiselle.
And now I'm going to my room for a few minutes. I'm very tired. We have a long trip ahead of us tomorrow.
Can I help you, Mademoiselle?
No, thank you. No. You must have moved that chair, Julie.
I'm sorry. I should have told you.
Doesn't matter. I'll have to get used to bumping into furniture. I suppose in time, I'll develop a sense of things being close to me.
I'm sure you will.
But until I do, I'll go barging around like a bull in a china shop. You'll need a lot of patience to put up with me, Julie. Now that I'm going to be blind.
Finale starred Miss Loreen Tuttle. Listen soon for another exciting story when one of your favorite motion picture stars meets the unexpected. This program was transcribed in Hollywood.
Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedron grove! A savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted by woman wailing for her demon lover. And from this chasm, the ceaseless turmoil seething, as if this earth in fast thick pants were breathing, a mighty fountain momently was forced, amid whose swift half-intermitted burst, huge fragments vaulted like rebounding hail, or chaffy grain beneath the thresher's flail, and mid these dancing rocks at once and ever, it flung up momently the sacred river. 5 miles meandering with a mazy motion through wood and dale the sacred river ran, then reached the caverns measureless to man, and sank in tumult to a lifeless ocean. And mid this tumult Kubla heard from far ancestral voices prophesying war. The shadow of the dome of pleasure floated midway on the waves, where was heard the mingled measure from the fountain and the caves. It was a miracle of rare device, a sunny pleasure dome with caves of ice. A damsel with her dulcimer in a vision once I saw. It was an Abyssinian maid, and on her dulcimer she played, singing of Mount Abora.
could I revive within me her symphony and song, to such a deep delight 'twould win me, that with music loud and long, I would build that dome in air, that sunny dome, those caves of ice, and all who heard should see them there, and all should cry, beware, beware, his flashing eyes, his floating hair. Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honey dew hath fed, and drunk the milk of paradise.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
Now, will you please go?
Shouldn't I kiss the bride? Isn't that what I'm supposed to do at a time like this?
No. Not until after the wedding.
I don't think I'll be able to attend. Thanks just the same. Have fun, Mona. Always have fun. And live a wonderful life. And forget about me. I know that won't take much effort. Goodbye, Mona. And good luck.
Can't you... You forgot your hat?